the boat surfaced in the scummy dead water under a jetty. The lid opened slowly.
"Smells like home," said Nobby.
"You can't trust the water," said Sergeant Colon.
"But I don't trust the water at home, Sarge."
Fred Colon managed to get a foothold on the greasy wood. It was, in theory, quite a heroic enterprise. He and Nobby Nobbs, the bold warriors, were venturing forth in hostile territory. Unfortunately, he knew they were doing it because Lord Vetinari was sitting in the boat and would raise his eyebrows in no uncertain manner if they refused. Colon had always thought that heroes had some special kind of clockwork that made them go out and die famously for God, country and apple pie, or whatever particular delicacy their mother made. It had never occurred to him that they might do it because they'd get yelled at if they didn't. He reached down.
"Come on up, Nobby," he said, "and remember we're doing this for the gods, Ankh-Morpork, and..."
It seemed to Colon that a foodstuff would indeed be somehow appropriate.
"And my mum's famous knuckle sandwich." "Our mum never made us knuckle sandwiches," said Nobby, as he hauled himself onto the planks, "but you'd be amazed at what she could do with a bit of cheese." "Yeah, all right, but that ain't much of a battle cry, is it? For the gods, Ankh-Morpork, and amazing things Nobby's mum can do with cheese. That'll strike fear in the hearts of the enemy," said Sergeant Colon as they crept forward. "Ah, well, if that's what you're after, you want my mum's distressed pudding and custard," said Nobby. "Frightening, is it? They wouldn't want to know about it, Sarge."
The docks of Alkali were like docks everywhere, because all docks everywhere are connected. Men have to put things on and off boats. There are only a limited number of ways to do this, so all docks look the same. Some are hotter, some are damper. There are always piles of vaguely forgotten-looking things. In the distance, there was the glow of the city, which seemed quite unaware of the enemy incursion.
"Get us some clothes so that we'll blend in," muttered Colon. "That's all very well to say."
Nah, that's easy," said Nobby. "Everyone knows how to do that one. You lurk in an alley somewhere, right? And you wait until a couple of blokes come by, and you lure them into the alley, see? And there's a couple of thumps, and then you come out wearing their clothes."
"That works, does it?"
"Never fails, Sarge,"
said Nobby, confidently. The desert looked like snow in the moonlight. Vimes found himself quite at ease with the Tacticus method of fighting. It was how coppers had always fought. A proper copper didn't line up with a lot of other coppers and rush at people. A copper lurked in the shadows, walked quietly, and bided his time. In all honesty, of course, the time he bided until was the point when the criminal had already committed the crime and was carrying the loot. Otherwise, what was the point? You had to be realistic. "We got the man who done it" carries a lot more gravitas than "we got the man what looked as if he was going to do it," especially when people say "prove it." Somewhere off to the left in the distance, someone screamed. Vimes was a bit uneasy in this robe, though. It was like going into battle in a nightshirt. Because he wasn't at all certain he could kill a man who wasn't actively trying to kill him. Of course, technically, any armed Clatchian these days was actively trying to kill him. That was what war was all about. But he raised his head over the top of the dune. A Clatchian warrior was looking the other way. Vimes crept.
"Bingly, bingly, bingly, beep. This is your 7 a.m. alarm call. Insert name here. At least I hope..."
"Huh? Damn."
Vimes reacted first and punched the man on the nose. Since there was no point in waiting to see what effect this would have, he threw himself forward, and the two of them rolled down the other side of the freezing dune, struggling and punching.
"But my real-time function seems erratic at the moment."
The Clatchian was smaller than Vimes. He was younger, too, but it was unfortunate for him that he appeared to be too young to have learned the repertoire of dirty fighting that spelled survival in Ankh-Morpork's backstreets. Vimes, on the other hand, was prepared to hit anything with anything. The point was that the opponent shouldn't get up again. Everything else was decoration. They slid to a halt at the bottom of the dune, with Vimes on top and the Clatchian groaning.
"Things to do,"
the disorganizer shrilled.
"Ache."
And then it was probably throat-cutting time. Back home, Vimes could have dragged him off to the cells in the knowledge that everything would look better in the morning, but the desert had no such options. No, he couldn't do that. Thump the bloke senseless, that was the merciful way.
"Vindaloo! Vindaloo!"
Vimes' fist stayed raised.
"What?
That's you, isn't it, Mr. Vimes? Vindaloo!"
Vimes pulled a fold of cloth away from the figure's face.
"Are you Gorif's boy?"
"I didn't want to be here, Mr. Vimes."
The words came fast, desperate. All right, all right, I'm not going to hurt you. Vimes lowered his fist and stood up, pulling the boy after him. Talk later, he muttered. Come on.
No, everyone knows what the dregs do to their captives.
Well, I'm their captive, and they'll have to do it to both of us, okay? Keep away from the more amusing food, and you'll probably be okay. Someone whistled in the darkness.
Come on, lad, hissed Vimes. No harm's going to come to you.
Well, less than it'd come to you if you stayed here, all right? This time he didn't give the boy time to argue, but dragged him along. As he headed towards the dregs' camp, other figures slid down the dunes. One of them had an arm missing and had a sword sticking in him.
How did you get on, Reg? Said Vimes.
A bit odd, sir. After the first one chopped my arm off and stabbed me, the rest of them seemed to keep out of my way. Honestly, you'd think they'd never seen a man stabbed before.
Did you find your arm? Reg waved something in the air.
That's another thing, he said. I hit a few of them with it, and they ran off screaming.
It's your type of unarmed combat, said Vimes. It probably takes some getting used to.
Is that a prisoner you've got there?
In a way, Vimes glanced around. He seems to have fainted. I can't think why. Reg leaned closer.
These foreigners are a bit weird, he said.
Reg?
Yes?
Your ear's hanging off.
Is it? Wretched thing. You'd think a nail would work, wouldn't you?
Sergeant Colon looked up at the stars. They looked down at him. At least Fred Colon had a choice. Beside him, Corporal Nobbs gave a groan. But the attackers had left him his pants. There are some places where the boldest dare not go, and those areas of Nobby upwards of the knees and downwards of the stomach were among them. Well, Colon thought of them as attackers. Technically, he supposed they were defenders. Aggressive defenders.
Just run all that past me again, will you? He said. We find a couple of blokes about our height and weight. We did that. We lure them into this alley. We did that. I take a swing at them with a length of wood and hit you by accident in the dark, and they get angry and turn out to be thieves and nick all our clothes.
We weren't supposed to do that.
Well, it worked,
basically, said Nobby, managing to get to his knees. We could give it another go.
Nobby, you're in a port, in a foreign city, clad only in your, and I use the word with feeling, Nobby, your unmentionables. This is not the point to start talking about luring people into alleys. There could be talk. Angua always says that nakedness is the national costume everywhere, Sarge.
She was talking about herself, Nobby, said Colon, sidling along in the shadows. It's different for you.
He peered around the other end of the alley. There was a noise and clatter from the building that formed one of the walls. A couple of laden donkeys waited patiently outside.
Nip out and grab one of those packs, right? Why me, Sarge? Because you're the corporal and I'm the sergeant, and you've got more on than me.
Grumbling under his breath, Nobby edged into the narrow street and unfastened a tether as fast as he could. The animal followed him obediently. Sergeant Colon pulled at the pack.
If push comes to shove, we can wear the sacks, he said. That'll... What's this?
He held up something red.
Flower pot? Said Nobby helpfully. It's a fez. Some Clatchians wear them. Looks like we struck lucky. Whoa, here's another one. Try it on, Nobby. And looks like one of them nightshirts they wear. And here's another one of those, too. We're home and dry, Nobby.
They're a bit short, Sarge.
Beggars can't be choosers, said Colon, struggling into the costume. Go on, put your fez on. It makes me look like a twit, Sarge. Look, I'll put mine on all right. Then we'll be fez to fez, Sarge.
Sergeant Colon gave him a severe look.
Did you have that one prepared, Nobby?
No, Sarge. I just made it up in my head right then.
Well, look, no calling me Sarge. That doesn't sound Clatchian.
Nor does Nobby, Sarge. Sorry.
Oh, I don't know. You could be Kenobi, or Nobby, or Nobby. Sounds pretty Clatchian to me.
What's a good Clatchian name for you, then?
I don't know hardly any, said Nobby.
Sergeant Colon didn't answer. He was peering round the corner again.
His lordship did say we was not to hang about, Nobby murmured. Yeah, but inside that tin can, well, it smells pretty lived in, if you know what I mean. What I wouldn't give for...
There was a bellow behind them. They turned. There were three Clatchian soldiers, or possibly watchmen. Nobby and Sergeant Colon didn't look much further than the swords. The leader growled a question at them.
What did he say?
Nobby quavered.
To know.
"Where are you from?" said the leader in Morporkian.
"What? Oh,
Colon hesitated, waiting for Shiny Death. "Ah, yes." The guard lowered his sword and jerked a thumb towards the docks. "You get back to your detachment now."
"Right," said Nobby.
"What your name?" one of the guards demanded.
"Nobby," said Nobby.
This seemed to pass. "And you, fat one?" Colon was panicking on the spot. He sought desperately for any name that sounded Clachian, and there was only one that presented itself and which was absolutely and authentically Clachian.
"Al,"
he said, his knees trembling.
"You get back right now or there will be trouble."
The watchman ran for it, dragging the donkey behind them, and didn't stop until they were on the greasy jetty, which somehow felt like home.
"What was all that about, sir, Al?" said Nobby. "All they wanted to do was push us around a bit. Typical watch behaviour," he added.
"Not ours, of course."
"I suppose we had the right clothes on."
"You didn't even tell them where we came from, and they spoke our language."
"Well, they... I mean, anyone ought to be able to speak Morporkian," said Colon, gradually regaining his mental balance. "Even babies learn it. I bet it comes easy after learning something as complicated as Clachian." "What are we going to do with the donkey, Al?"
"Do you think it can pedal?"
"I doubt it."
"Then leave it up here."
"But it'll get pinched, Al."
"Oh, these Clachians'll pinch anything."
"Not like us, eh, Al?"
Nobby looked at the forest of masts filling the bay.
"Looks like even more of them from here," he said. "You could walk from boat to boat for a mile."
"What are they all here for?"
"Don't be daft, Nobby, it's obvious. They're here to take everyone to Ankh Morpork."
"What for? We don't eat that much curry."
"Invasion, Nobby. There's a war on, remember?"
They looked back at the ships. Riding lights gleamed on the water. The bit of it that was immediately below them bubbled for a moment, and then the hull of the boat rose a few inches above the surface. The lid unscrewed, and Leonard's worried face appeared.
"Ah, there you are," he said. "We were getting concerned."
They lowered themselves down into the fetid interior of the vessel. Lord Vetinari was sitting with a pad of paper across his knees, writing carefully. He glanced up briefly.
"Report."
Nobby fidgeted while Sergeant Colon delivered a more or less accurate account, although there was some witty repartee with the Clachian guards that the corporal had not hitherto recalled. Vetinari did not look up. Still writing, he said,
"Sergeant, Ur is an old country rimward of the kingdom of Jellababy, whose occupants are a byword for bucolic stupidity. For some reason, I cannot think why, the guard must have assumed you were from there. And Morporkian is something of a lingua franca, even in the Clachian Empire. When someone from Hersheba needs to trade with someone from Istanzia, they will undoubtedly haggle in Morporkian. This will serve us well, of course. The force that is being assembled here must mean that practically every man is a distant stranger with outlandish ways. Provided we do not act too foreign, we should pass muster. This means not asking for curry with swede and currants in it, and refraining from ordering pints of Winkle's Old Peculiar, do I make myself clear?"
What is it we're going to do, sir?" "We will reconnoitre, initially."
"Ah, right. Yes, very important. And then seek out the Clachian High Command. Thanks to Leonard, I have a little package to deliver. I hope it will end the war very quickly."
Sergeant Colon looked blank. At some point in the last few seconds, the conversation had run away with him.
"Sorry, sir, you said High Command, sir."
"Yes, Sergeant. Like the top brass, or turbans or whatever, all surrounded by crack troops, sir. That's where you always put the best troops, around the top brass."
"I expect this will be the case, yes. In fact, I rather hope it is."
Sergeant Colon once again tried to keep up.
"Ah, right.
And we'll go and look for them, will we, sir?"
"I can hardly ask them to come to us, Sergeant." "Right, sir, I can see that. It could be a bit crowded."
At last, Lord Vetinari looked up.
"Is there some problem, Sergeant?"
And Sergeant Colon once again knew a secret about bravery. It was arguably a kind of enhanced cowardice. The knowledge that while death may await you if you advance, it will be a picnic compared to the certain living hell that awaits you should you retreat.
Ah,
Not as such, sir, he said. Very well. Vetinari pushed his paperwork aside. If there is more suitable clothing in your bag, I will get changed and we can take a look at Al-Khali. Oh, gods! Sorry, Sergeant. Oh, good, sir. Good. Vetinari began to pull other items out of the liberated sack. There was a set of juggler's clubs, a bag of coloured balls, and finally a placard such as might be placed to one side of the stage during an artiste's performance. Gully, Gully and Betty, he read. Exotic tricks and dances. He added. It would seem there was a lady among the owners of this sack. The watchman looked at the gauzy material that came out of the sack next. Nobby's eyes bulged. What are them? I believe they're called harem pants, Corporal. They're very, Curiously, the purpose of the clothing of the Nautch girl or exotic dancer has always been less to reveal and more to suggest the imminence of revelation, said the patrician. Nobby looked down at his costume and then at Sergeant Al Colon in his costume and said cheerfully, Well, I ain't sure if it's going to suit you, sir. He regretted the words immediately. I hadn't intended that they should suit me, said the patrician calmly. Please pass me your fez, Corporal Betty. The subtle, deceiving dawn before dawn slid over the desert, and the commander of the Clachian detachment wasn't happy about it. The Daregs always attacked at dawn, all of them. It didn't matter how many of them there were, or how many of you there were. Anyway, the whole tribe attacked. It wasn't just the women and children, but the camels, goats, sheep and chickens too. Of course you were expecting them, and bows could cut them down, but they always appeared suddenly, as if even the desert had spat them out. Get it wrong, be too slow, and you'd be hacked, kicked, butted, pecked, and viciously spat at. His troops lay in wait. Well, if you could call them troops, he'd said they were overstretched. Well, he hadn't actually said, because that sort of thing could get you into trouble in this man's army, but he'd thought it very hard. Half of them were keen kids who thought that if you went into battle shouting and waving your sword in the air, the enemy just ran away. They'd never faced a dreg chicken coming in at eye height. As for the rest of it, in the night people had run into one another, ambushed one another by mistake, and were now as jittery as peas on a drum. A man had lost his sword and swore that someone had walked away with it, stuck right through him, and some kind of rock had got up and walked around him hitting people, with other people. The sun was well up now.
It's the waiting that's the worst part, said his sergeant next to him.
It might be the worst part, said the commander. Or there again, the bit where they suddenly rise out of the desert and cut you in half might be the worst part.
He stared mournfully at the treacherously empty sand.
Or the bit where a maddened sheep tries to gnaw your nose off might be the worst part. In fact, when you think of all the things that can happen when you're surrounded by a horde of screaming dregs, the bit where they aren't there at all is, I think you'll find, the best part.
The sergeant wasn't trained for this sort of thing, so he said,
They're late.
Good. Rather them than us.
Sun's right up now, sir.
The commander looked at his shadow. It was full day, and the sand was mercifully free of his blood. The commander had been pacifying various recalcitrant parts of Clatch for long enough to wonder why, if he was pacifying people, he always seemed to be fighting them. Experience had taught him never to say things like, I don't like it, it's too quiet. There was no such thing as too quiet.
They might have decamped in the night, sir, said the sergeant.
That doesn't sound like the dregs. They never run away. Anyway, I can see their tents.
Why don't we rush 'em, sir?
You haven't fought dregs before, sergeant?
No, sir. I've been pacifying the mad savatars in Uhistan, though, and there...
The dregs are worse, sergeant. They pacify right back at you.
I didn't say how mad the Savatars were, sir.
Compared to the dregs, they were merely slightly vexed.
The sergeant felt that his reputation was being impugned.
How about I take a few men and investigate, sir?
The commander glanced at the sun again. Already the air was too hot to breathe.
Oh, very well. Let's go.
The Clachians advanced on the camp. There were the tents and the ash of fires, but there were no camels and horses, merely a long scuffed trail leading off among the dunes. Morale began to rise a little. Attacking a dangerous enemy who isn't there is one of the more attractive forms of warfare, and there was a certain amount of assertion about how lucky the dregs were to have run away in time, and some extemporizing on the subject of what the soldiers would have done to the dregs if they'd caught them. "Who's that?" said the sergeant. A figure appeared between the dunes riding on a camel. His white robes fluttered in the breeze. He slid down when he reached the Clatchians and waved at them.
"Good morning, gentlemen. May I persuade you to surrender?"
"Who are you?"
"Captain Carrot, sir. If you would be kind enough to lay down your weapons, no one will get hurt."
The commander looked up. Blobs were appearing along the tops of the dunes. They rose and turned out to be heads.
"They're dregs, sir," said the sergeant.
"No, dregs would be charging, sergeant."
"Oh, sorry. Shall I tell them to charge?" said Carrot. "Is that what you'd prefer?"
The dregs were all along the dunes now. The climbing sun glittered off metal.
"Are you telling me," the commander began slowly, "that you can persuade dregs not to charge?"
"It was tricky, but I think they've got the idea," said Carrot.
The commander considered his position. There were dregs on either side. His troop were practically huddling together, and this red-headed, blue-eyed man was smiling at him.
"How do they feel about the merciful treatment of prisoners?" he ventured.
"I think they could get the hang of it if I insist."
The commander glanced at the silent dregs again.
"Why?" he said. "Why aren't they fighting us?" he said.
"My commander says he doesn't want unnecessary loss of life, sir," said Carrot.
"That's Commander Vimes, sir. He's sitting on that dune up there."
"You can persuade armed dregs not to charge, and you have a commander?"
"Yes, sir. He says this is a police action."
The commander swallowed.
"We give in," he said. "What, just like that, sir?" said his sergeant. "Without a fight?" "Yes, sergeant, without a fight. This man can make water run uphill, and he has a commander. I love the idea of giving in without a fight. I've fought for 10 years, and giving in without a fight is what I've always wanted to do."
Water dripped off the boat's metal ceiling and blobbed onto the paper in front of Leonard of Querm. He wiped it away. It might have been boring, waiting in the small metal can under a nondescript jetty, but Leonard had no concept of the term. Absent-mindedly, he jotted a brief sketch of an improved ventilation system. He started to watch his own hand. Almost without his guidance, taking its instructions from somewhere else in his head, it drew a cutaway of a much larger version of the boat. Here, here, and here, there could be a bank of 100 oars rather than pedals, each one manned, his pencil caressed the paper, by a well-muscled and not overest young warrior. A boat that would pass unseen under other boats, take men wherever they needed to go. Here, a giant saw affixed to the roof, so that when rowed at speed it could cut the hulls of enemy ships. And here, a tube. He stopped and stared at his drawing for a while. Then he sighed and started to tear it up. Vimes watched from the dune. He couldn't hear much from up here, but he didn't need to. Angua sat down beside him.
"It's working, isn't it?" she said.
"Yes."
"What's he going to do?"
"Oh, he'll take their weapons and let them go, I suppose."
"Why do people follow him?" said Angua.
"Well, you're his girlfriend. You ought to know."
"That's different. I love him because he's kind without thinking about it. He doesn't watch his own thoughts like other people do. When he does good things, it's because he's decided to do them, not because he's trying to measure up to something. He's so simple. Anyway, I'm a wolf living with people, and there's a name for wolves that live with people. If he whistled, I'd come running."
Vimes tried not to show his embarrassment. Angua smiled.
"Don't worry, Mr. Vimes, you've said it yourself. Sooner or later, we're all someone's dog."
"It's like hypnotism," said Vimes hurriedly. "People follow him to see what's going to happen next. They tell themselves that they're just going along with it for a while and can stop at any time they want to, but they never want to. It's damn magic."
"No. Have you ever really watched him?
I bet he'd found out everything about Jabbar by the time he'd talked to him for 10 minutes. I bet he knows the name of every camel, and he'll remember it all. People don't take much interest in other people, usually."
Her fingers idly traced a pattern in the sand.
"So he makes you feel important."
"Politicians do that,"
Vimes began. "Not the way he does, believe me. I expect Lord Vetinari remembers facts about people."
"Oh, you'd better believe that."
"But Carrot takes an interest. He doesn't even think about it. He makes space in his head for people. He takes an interest, and so people think they're interesting. They feel better when he's around."
Vimes glanced down. Her fingers were drawing aimlessly in the sand again. "We're all changing in the desert," he thought. "It's not like the city, hemming your thoughts in. You can feel your mind expand to the horizons. No wonder this is where religions start. And suddenly, here I am, probably not legally, just trying to do my job. Why? Because I'm too damn stupid to stop and think before I give chase, that's why. Even Carrot knew better than to do that. I'd have just chased after Ahmed's ship without a thought, but he was bright enough to report back to me first. He did what a responsible officer ought to do. But me... Vetinari's terrier," he said aloud. "Chase first and think about it afterwards." His eye caught the distant bulk of Gebra. Out there was a Klatchian army, and somewhere over there was the Ankh-Morpork army, and he was with a handful of people and no plan because he'd chased first, and... "But I had to," he said. "Any copper wouldn't have let a suspect like Ahmed get..." Once again, he had the feeling that the problem he was facing wasn't really a problem at all. It was something very obvious. He was the problem. He wasn't thinking right. Come to think of it, he hadn't really thought at all. He glanced down again at the trapped company. They had stripped down to their loincloths and were looking very sheepish, as men generally do in their underwear. Carrot's white robe still flapped in the breeze. "He hasn't been here a day," thought Vimes, "and already he's wearing the desert like a pair of sandals."
Bingley, 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 beep.
"Is that your demon diary?" said Angua. Vimes rolled his eyes.
"Yes, although it seems to be talking about someone else."
3 p.m.,
the demon muttered slowly.
"Day not filled in. Check wall defences."
"See, he thinks I'm in Ankh-Morpork. It costs Sybil $300 and it can't even keep track of where I am."
He flicked his cigar butt away and stood up.
"I'd better get down there," he said. "After all, I am the boss."
He slithered his way down the dune and strolled towards Carrot, who salaamed to him.
"A salute would do, Captain. Thanks all the same."
"Sorry, sir. I think I got a bit carried away."
"Why have you made them strip off?"
"Makes them a bit of a laughing stock when they return, sir. A blow to their pride." He leaned closer and whispered, "I've let their commander keep his clothes on, though. It doesn't do to show up the officers."
"Really?" said Vimes.
"And some want to join us, sir. There's Gorif's lad and a few others. They were just dragooned into the army yesterday. They don't even know why they're fighting, so I said they could."
Vimes took the captain aside.
"I don't remember suggesting that any of the prisoners joined us," he said quietly.
"Well, sir, I thought what with our army approaching, and since quite a lot of these lads are from various corners of the Empire and don't like the Klatchians any more than we do, I thought that a flying column of guerrilla fighters..."
"We aren't soldiers."
"I thought we were soldiers."
"Yes, yes, all right, in a way. But really, we're coppers, like we've always been. We don't kill people unless..."
"Ahmed?" "Everyone's slightly on edge when he's around. He worries people. He gets information from all over the place. He seems to go where he pleases, and he's always around where there's trouble. Damn, damn, damn." He ran through the crowd until he reached Jabbar, who was watching Carrot with the usual puzzled smile that Carrot caused in innocent bystanders.
3 days, said Vimes. 3 days. That's 72 hours.
Yes, Effendi, said Jabbar.
It was the voice of someone who recognized dawn, noon, and sunset, and just let everything in between happen whenever it liked.
"So why is he called 71-hour Ahmed? What's so special about the extra hour?"
Jabbar grinned nervously.
"Did he do something after 71 hours?" said Vimes.
Jabbar folded his arms.
"I will not say."
"He told you to keep us here?"
"Yes."
"But not to kill us?"
"Oh, I would not kill my friend, Sir Sam Mule."
"And don't give me all that eyeball rubbish," said Vimes. "He wanted time to get somewhere and do something, right?"
"I will not say."
"You don't need to," said Vimes, "because we are leaving. And if you kill us, well, probably you can, but 71-hour Ahmed would not like that, I expect."
Jabbar looked like a man making a difficult decision.
"He will be coming back," he said. "Tomorrow. No problem."
"I'm not waiting, and I don't think he wants me killed, Jabbar. He wants me alive. Carrot?" Carrot hurried over.
"Yes, sir?"
Vimes was aware that Jabbar was staring at him in horror. "We've lost Ahmed," he said. "Even Agua can't pick up his trail with the sand blowing all over the place. We've got no place here. We're not needed here."
"But we are, sir," Carrot burst out. "We could help the desert tribes."
"Oh, you want to stay and fight," said Vimes, "against the Clatchians? Against the bad Clatchians, sir?" "Ah, well, that's the trick, isn't it? When one of them comes screaming at you, waving a sword, how do you spot his moral character? Well, you can stay if you like and fight for the good name of Ankh Morpork. It should be a pretty short fight, but I'm off. Jenkins probably hasn't got afloat again. Okay, Jabbar?" The dreg was staring at the desert sand between his feet. "You know where he is now, don't you?" Vimes prompted.
"Yes."
"Tell me."
"No, I swore to him."
"But dregs are oath breakers, everyone knows that." Jabbar gave Vimes a grin.
"Oh, oaths. Stupid things. I gave him my word."
"He won't break it, sir," said Carrot. "Dregs are very particular about things like that. It's only when they swear on gods and things that they'll ever break an oath."
"I will not tell you where he is," said Jabbar. "But..."
He grinned again, but there was no humour in it.
"How brave are you, Mr. Vimes?"